This is a Yahoo Finance special, Market Movers. Stocks are near all-time highs, powered by a strong economy and an accommodating Fed. Earnings for big tech and the blue chips are stronger than ever, and Wall Street is looking forward to another quarter of record profits. But many money managers are warning of what's to come. Supply chain issues, rising inflation, and the specter of higher taxes all cause for concern. Now, in the final quarter of the year, the stock market has already begun to wobble. Over the next hour, we'll hear from some of the street's top insiders and what they're watching. Join us now for this Yahoo Finance special as we help you stay one step ahead of the market. Welcome to this Yahoo Finance special presentation of Market Movers. I'm Alexis Christophorus, coming to you live from the NASDAQ market site in New York City's Times Square. Stocks kicking off a new trading week with a big decline as bond yields rise once again. This, of course, the second trading day of the fourth quarter. And as you can see, stocks across the board taking a big hit. The NASDAQ composite on a percentage basis falling the most, now off 2.5%. Investors waiting for clarity on everything from inflation and the debt ceiling to the job market and trade with China. Yahoo Finance's Emily McCormick is standing by with more for us. Emily?
Well, Alexis, as you mentioned, we're seeing stocks sinking across the board this afternoon on the second trading day of October and the fourth quarter. Now, each of the S&P 500, Dow, and NASDAQ are lower, with the NASDAQ the big underperformer here as traders continue to rotate away from those technology and growth stocks that had led the market higher last year. Now, the S&P 500 had posted a strong start to the month on Friday, rising by more than 1% in its best start to a month of October since 2007, but definitely a different story this afternoon. Now, likewise, the NASDAQ is looking like it will be down by another more than 2.5% today, extending some of that volatility we saw in markets last week, especially as we're seeing Treasury yields rising across the curve. Now, by sector, again, tech really is getting battered here today. Information technology and the communication services sectors are the worst performers in the S&P 500 this afternoon. Energy, on the other hand, is outperforming, and that's coming as we're seeing crude oil prices also jumping after OPEC Plus agreed to only gradually increase monthly oil production after their latest meeting earlier today. But broadening out, as we were mentioning, Alexis, a number of factors are weighing on risk assets and equities during today's session. There are those ongoing concerns over the debt ceiling debate, with congressional Democrats and Republicans still struggling to come to an agreement on raising the government borrowing limit to prevent a potential default as soon as this month. And of course, investors are also continuing to assess ongoing concerns around inflation after last week's higher than expected PCE reading. And amid all of these concerns, as you can see on the screen here, we do have the CBOE volatility index spiking to above 24 again today. And then taking a look in terms of some individual big stock movers, I want to highlight Facebook. Now, we are seeing this stock down by more than 5%, pacing toward its worst day in nearly a year. And that's after a whistleblower who turned over Facebook's internal research to the Wall Street Journal stepped forward and revealed herself on CBS yesterday, and she criticized the company for, quote, putting profit over safety of its users. Now, the company also dealing with an outage of Facebook and Instagram impacting thousands of users today, so that stock is on the decline. And then finally, do you want to take a quick moment here to highlight shares of Tesla? They are bucking the trend of the broader market, still holding slightly higher this afternoon, and that's after posting record quarterly deliveries over the weekend. But overall, again, Alexis, seeing a big down day as we look at these three major stock indexes.
All right, Emily McCormick, thanks so much. You know, the stock market just came off its worst monthly performance since the start of the pandemic. And of course, today we have sharply lower stocks across the board. So when are things going to turn around? To help us answer that question, I'm joined by Andrew Sliman, Senior Portfolio Manager at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, and Francis Donald, Global Chief Economist at Manulife. Thank you both for being with us. And Francis, I want to start with you. You know, I don't mean to be a naysayer here, but two of the worst market crashes occurred in the month of October. There's lots of uncertainty swirling around fiscal and monetary policy right now. What is your outlook for the fourth quarter?
It's never been harder to create an outlook for the fourth quarter, in large part because we have absolutely no clarity on when these supply chain disruptions are going to unwind. These are creating a massive amount of havoc in the growth outlook. And I want to emphasize growth outlook here, because we're at a point where we tend to view supply chain disruptions and higher prices as being inflationary. That means rates need to move higher. But we're at an inflection point where I believe they're going to start to really hamper the growth side of the picture. And if they do that, it's an entirely different outlook altogether. It means the Fed can't raise interest rates to hit supply chains, which wouldn't work anyways. And they need to start focusing on making sure that the fundamentals in the underlying economy remain solid. So the supply chains are everything at this point. And I would add a layer onto that, which is energy. A lot of people watching stocks dropping today. I'm watching those higher energy prices. They have so many downstream impacts on the global economy. That's the ticker that I'm watching all day today and probably the rest of the quarter.
Yeah, great point you bring up. I wanted to bring up oil too. And Andrew, I'm going to ask you about this. We see crude oil prices now at their highest level since 2014 after OPEC said it's not going to make any big changes to its output. How much of oil rising is going to be a problem for this economy to overcome higher inflation?
Sure. So look, rapid increases in oil prices puts a serious damper on the economy, and that is a potential negative out there. But I also think that, you know, like, look, we're so due for a correction of 10%. I mean, it hasn't happened in over a year. So the market's pulling back. And, you know, on average, you get about a 10% correction every year. That's going back the last 100 years. But there's only been 17, 20% corrections. So 10% pullbacks are buying opportunities on average. The key question is, could this be the 18th 20% plus correction? And if you look at those big corrections, they come with growth scares where suddenly people, oh my gosh, the economy is turning lower, not higher. And I would argue that if the economy is turning lower, how come interest rates are going up? How come reopening stocks are leading the charge? How come energy is going up? I don't think this is a growth scare. We already had the growth scare. It started in the spring. So in my mind, we're due for a correction. I would be a buyer into more of a pullback. I wouldn't be running for the hills.
All right. Well, there we go. So sort of a silver lining there from Andrew. But Francis, I want to talk about another possible catalyst for this market, and that's going to be earnings. We've already seen a few trickle in. FedEx and Bed Bath & Beyond underwhelmed, to put it lightly. Are you thinking that it's going to be a bad earnings season? And could we be in for an earnings recession, meaning two quarters of negative earnings growth?
Well, look, I'm a macro strategist, and even I have the ability to step back sometimes and say that the correlation coefficient on macro is probably going to be less. I have to agree with Andrew here that the growth scare probably happened, and we've seen a better alignment of expectations for higher inflation and lower growth. But where earnings come into play, especially as a macro strategist like myself, is that we're still going to have pockets of really high price pressures that are going to make business hard for select areas. So we need to be watching the earnings season, not necessarily because of its broad impact. Of course, that matters to the market, but because we need to really be in a stock picker's market where those who understand these companies are seeing who's going to get whacked by the supply chain issues and who's going to benefit from the underlying fundamentals that, as Andrew said, are improving going into 2022. And that's what I'm going to be looking at, all those aggregate, who is mentioning supply chains, who's afraid of inflation, which sectors are going to get most hurt in that. That's the key from my view.
So, Andrew, if you're not running for the hills, what are you gravitating towards right now? Where do you see leadership in the fourth quarter coming from?
Yeah, so look, I guess it's a great show you're having because you've got a macro strategist and a portfolio manager who runs equity funds. And going into earnings season, what scares me to death is when there's high expectation going into earnings season, where at the whisper number, companies are expected to beat the whisper number. I love going into earnings season when there's low expectation, and that's the setup right now. Now, I wouldn't disagree that supply chains issues are impacting some of the companies, but I would remind you that not every company in the United States imports their goods from Asia, right? So let's focus on companies that don't import their goods from Asia, because the setup going into earnings season is very good. So I really like financial. I like the value trade. I'm delighted we're finally getting this growth sell-off, because there's too much money has been chasing tech, and rising rates are telling you you want to have more of a weighting in financials. I think that's a great place with low expectations going into earnings season, and there's no supply chain issues in that area.
And also, they tend to do well in an environment of higher interest rates. And it looks like, Francis, that's what we're going to get from the Federal Reserve. They've made pretty clear they're looking at raising rates as early as next year. What is that going to do to the overall inflation picture? What is that going to accomplish?
I'm not sure the Fed is going to hike in 2022. I think it's a late 2023 type of environment. And one of the reasons is exactly the question you made, which what impact is it going to have? The bulk of the inflationary pressures that we have right now, maybe not in the future, but right now are supply side driven, and as Andrew mentioned, isolated to certain segments of the economy, not broad based. So you can hike interest rates and pull back on demand a little bit, but it's not going to put a dent in the inflation, which is largely supply side driven. That's the sticky situation that the Fed is in right now. They're probably going to have to look a lot more at growth and employment than they are that inflation number. And even I got to tell you the math of it. Remember, CPI math is not real life. The math of inflation is going to come down mechanically in 2022. That's going to give them a little bit more breathing space. But the biggest reason of all, and you know, it's a little uncomfortable to talk about, but we have a giant fiscal drop in 2022. There is a massive decline in fiscal spending happening in 2022. Even when we get infrastructure spending, it's really hard on an economy to have both monetary and fiscal tightening. I don't think we're going to have the 2022 hike that even half of the FOMC currently has penciled in.
All right, we'll have to wait and see. Francis Donald, Andrew Sliman, thank you both for joining us today. And coming up, we're going to continue our live coverage from the NASDAQ here in New York City with the president of the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, Nelson Griggs, up next. Welcome back to Yahoo Finance's Market Movers. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in New York City's Times Square. The global pandemic actually was not enough to discourage companies from going public. In fact, 2021 is already a record year for initial public offerings, even more than during the dot-com bubble of 2000. And the NASDAQ continues to be the leading U.S. exchange for technology, consumer, and healthcare IPOs. Joining me now is the president of the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, Nelson Griggs. Nelson, good to be here with
you. Welcome, Alexis. Great to have you here.
What a year for IPOs.
It's been amazing.
You have welcomed over, year to date, over 550 new companies here at the exchange, including some high profile ones like Duolingo and Robinhood. Yeah. Tell us what's on tap in the fall and what does the fourth quarter look like?
Yeah, so of the 560 companies that have been public, over 250 have been operating companies. So that is enormous in its own right. And then we've raised the most capital ever already on NASDAQ this year. So that sets up for a big fall because there's a very, very healthy pipeline. You've seen some of the names file already. Next week we have GitLab, we have AvidXchange. And then following that, there's quite a bit more in the consumer, tech, and healthcare space. Now obviously the markets have to cooperate.
Right, and they're not cooperating today, of course. Tech continuing to get hit, and we continue to see this rotation out of technology. Because the NASDAQ is so concentrated with tech companies, when you have days like these or periods like these, what does it do to the overall exchange?
Well, to the exchange, it's obviously a day where you want to make sure you're trading efficiently, there's resiliency and things of that nature. But if you do look back at where you are from multiples, where the market is historically, it is still very, very high, very positive. I think you look, one day is not going to be a microcosm of the entire year. September was a bit of a sell-off, but it's also on the backdrop of just, again, tremendous growth over 20 and 21.
Let's talk about some of the ways these companies are choosing to come to market.
Sure.
I know Amplitude happened just a week or two ago, and that was with a direct listing.
Yeah.
SPACs were huge late last year and early this year, and then they sort of fell off a cliff as the SEC is now looking to regulate them. Are you seeing SPACs make a comeback? Or are they starting to stabilize?
Yeah, well, the SEC has always regulated SPACs. I think they're taking a little closer look in terms of the mechanics of how the combinations happen and how the forward projections are basically being put out by the not only the SPAC, but also the combination company. So there's we've had a very active SPAC year. There's still many combinations going on. It is taking longer for the combinations to actually go through. So we'll see how it shakes out. But I think if you're a sitting company, you're looking at these options to say, I have the route of a traditional IPO, I can consider SPACs, which they're getting many calls from the sponsors to consider going public that way. Then you also have direct listing just starting to pick up a little bit of activity as well, too. So it's a great time to be a private company.
So the most popular way, if you will, to go public is still the traditional IPO. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, if you look at over 250 IPOs on NASDAQ going the traditional route versus direct listings being a much, much smaller number, you know, two so far this year, it's still predominantly seen traditional IPOs.
I want to talk for a minute about activity you're seeing coming out of China.
Sure.
Because the number of Chinese listings in the U.S. Basically dried up over the summer. The SEC still continues to want more transparency from these companies. They want to audit their books. China continues to push back. What are you seeing in terms of demand coming from China and for investors wanting a piece of those companies?
Yeah, I'd say we are definitely in a pause moment with Chinese companies. At the same time, we're seeing activity pick up in the rest of Asia Pacific, more companies from Australia, Singapore, et cetera. India as well is starting to be an attractive market. And Freshworks has a huge heritage in India that went public here in the U.S. just recently. So I think you're looking at China's on a pause. We do need to see the regulators come together and say, you know, what's the right framework for transparency, disclosures, for that really to kind of get the activity level that we saw prior to the slowdown.
Do you think that delisting some of these Chinese companies could really be on the table? And are you seeing investors get a little antsy as that becomes more of a possibility? Meaning, are they going to start dumping U.S. ADRs and looking to other exchanges like Hong Kong to buy into those Chinese companies?
You definitely see an increased volatility, right? So any time there's a news or a headline come out about what might be happening in China or happening in the U.S., you have seen those stocks sell off fairly significantly. So I think we really need to understand that in terms of delistings, we have a ways to go there to understand, can the regulators come together? That's what the important thing. Hopefully we can work together because there's some great companies. We'd love to see the U.S. investors have access to them. But really, again, we need the regulators to try to come to the table together.
Recently, you've won some business from other exchanges. I know that Xerox came to NASDAQ. Are you seeing more of that trend? And why are companies telling you they're making the switch?
Yeah, we're up to now over $2 trillion in market cap switching. We're obviously happy with Xerox coming to NASDAQ. We've had Honeywell this year, one of the first Dow 30 stocks to switch. So we work really tirelessly at NASDAQ to build up a life cycle story. We help companies think about their IR programs or governance programs. We have this wonderful facility here for visibility. We do a lot on that. So I think it's been quite a bit of trend. We also have a very good IPO win rate, so we're feeling pretty good about our story.
Now, I know last year the NASDAQ did something no exchange has done yet, and that is to propose new rules that would mandate diversity on companies' boardrooms or in companies' boardrooms. You know, some people think it's overreaching, that this is not the place of an exchange to tell private capital how to deal with their boards. But what are you hearing from companies right now? And if companies are not in compliance, do they risk being delisted?
Well, again, it's not a mandate for having board diversity. It's a mandate for disclosure. So we do need companies to disclose what their board diversity is over a period of time.
Okay.
And then we have a recommendation for what board diversity would look like. And if you don't have that, you have the ability to explain to your investors why you don't. So it's really more of a disclosure rule than a mandate rule. Mm-hmm. And if you look at where investors are going, where we believe companies are going, it's something that we felt was important to have something in place to give some framework. And it's been, I'd say, well received, not by everybody. We have a lot of discussions that we do have to go through about the why. Mm-hmm. But we feel very confident in the fact that we've come out there with a good long-term approach.
Now, I know we're here in person, something that I personally haven't done in about 18 months. Yeah. You're having more and more bell ceremonies actually here, closing and opening bell ceremonies. How are companies responding to that? Yeah. And I'm also curious if there are any changes that you implemented during the pandemic that will stay with the NASDAQ.
Yeah, two great questions. So obviously, we have to follow all the guidelines. We also have a testing regime in place, as well as requiring vaccinations if you're going to be here in person, for the protection of our companies and our employees, but companies want to be here. So we have an amazing celebratory first day. We've had companies bring over 100 people or so. Their employees get involved because it is a culmination of years of hard work, and they want to celebrate. They want to showcase their brands to the world. So we have a wonderful platform to do that. So we're excited to continue that. You'll see more of that happening this fall. And then I think the biggest thing that's changed in the pandemic is it used to be the folks that were here in person felt the most attention. But we have had a wonderful experience of bringing the employees around the globe into the experience here or virtually. So there's a NASDAQ app where they can go in, download the application. They can go and watch the ceremonies. They can download their own pictures at home. They show up on the big billboard in Times Square. We've gotten more and more compliments from companies saying, wow, it felt like it was a whole inclusive event here at NASDAQ. So it's been fun. That's going to stay.
That's awesome. Yeah. We've all found ways to sort of beef up our virtual presence,
haven't we?
Nelson Griggs, president of the NASDAQ Market Site, thanks so much.
Thanks for being here. Thanks.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us. Yeah. Straight ahead, where Washington meets Wall Street, how Capitol Hill lawmakers could affect your fourth quarter bottom line. That's next. 9 months into his presidency, and Joe Biden's legislative agenda is in doubt. The U.S. is racing to avoid a potentially catastrophic default, while House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has set a new deadline of October 31st for a vote on infrastructure and a social spending bill. Joining me to discuss what this all means for investors is Andrew Bush, former Chief Market Intelligence Officer at the CFTC, and Ed Mills, Chief Policy Analyst at Raymond James. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being with us today. Andrew, I'm going to start with you. How confident are you that we get an 11th hour agreement and avoid the first ever default in our nation's history?
Yeah, it's going to be ugly for a while. You saw the comments by Senator McConnell in his discussions with Joe Biden. I think it's going to be kind of close. I think it's got the biggest risk for the financial markets, but I think it's got the smallest probability. I do think they'll find a way forward, but Senator McConnell is going to make it really difficult on the Democrats to move forward on a debt ceiling hike because they have moved forward without any Republican support over the last 6 months. And I don't think that's going to change soon.
You know, we saw Treasury Secretary Yellen say, you know what, maybe we just do away with the debt ceiling altogether, Ed. What do you think about that? And if this were to happen, if it were to happen, even though there is a small probability, it would squash confidence in the U.S. dollar. But what would it do to the U.S. stock market?
You know, I don't think it's going to happen because that needs 60 votes in the Senate to kind of overcome the filibuster. And so I think a lot of what this is about is it's not about the debt limit. That's going to get done. This is really a larger kind of conversation about the filibuster itself and other Democratic priorities. It does have the chance of increasing volatility near term, Alexis. But I think most investors that I speak to really feel like, you know, 6 months from now, we're not going to be talking about this. So they're not trading around that. It's going to get a little bit kind of concerning as we get closer to the X date. So the vol will be there, but I don't think a long-term market impact will be there for the stock market.
You know, Yahoo Finance's Adam Shapiro interviewed former President Donald Trump late last week. It was a far-reaching interview. In it, Trump said that the country would be, quote, ravaged by rising inflation. And I want you to listen to what he had to say about the debt ceiling, and then I'll get your reaction.
We're in trouble no matter what. If you raise it, that's not a good thing because the bill is so bad, the $3.5 trillion. And if you raise it, bad. And if you don't raise it, bad. It's a bad situation to be in. The bottom line is the $3.5 trillion plus $1.2 trillion plus other things that we had to do for COVID, et cetera, et cetera. You're talking about historic numbers. And I just don't know if this economy can take it.
Now, Trump seems to be conflating the debt ceiling with the spending plan. But, Andrew, what do you make of former President Trump's remarks there?
Well, shockingly, he got the inflation component right. I mean, that's the biggest problem right now for the Fed. And I will say this, if both of these bills pass, even a smaller social infrastructure spending bill of like somewhere between $2 to $2.2 trillion, along with the $1.2 trillion, you're going to get extended inflation all over the place in the U.S. economy. Supply chain side, you know, problems aside, you're going to have a lot of demand for things like housing with all of the affordable housing plans that the second bill has. So there's a lot of inflationary impact that's going to extend beyond what's happening today, well into 2022. And the real risk for the markets right now is that the Fed speeds up their tapering and the markets are not anticipating that at all. That would cause a decent-sized correction in the S&P.
But, Andrew, hasn't the Fed done a pretty good job of being transparent? It's hard to believe this market hasn't started pricing in the tapering yet.
No, they're pricing in the tapering. I'm saying that if they move forward faster on it. So, in other words, your November meeting, they more aggressive in their tapering, and they move forward their dot plots for when they're going to raise rates. That's the risk for the market right now, especially if Democrats pass both of these bills. That's the risk.
Ed, let's talk about both of those bills, infrastructure, social spending. We saw that President Biden's approval rating sank to, I think, just below 50% last month. How important is getting those two pieces of legislation through? How important that is that to the midterm elections next year?
Alexis, for Democrats, they think it's everything. And that's part of the reason why I've been of the belief they're going to happen. A lot of Democrats are in this mode of go big or go home. Some would say they are going to have a hard time in the midterm elections, even with getting this done. So faced with the real prospect of loss, that's a huge motivating factor. We continue to look at some of these deadlines, you know, the expiration of the surface transportation bill that you highlighted, Alexis, the end of the child tax credit in December. Those are things that are pushing Democrats to getting this done, and they really want to change the narrative. They are fully aware of Biden's approval ratings, fully aware of how many headwinds they're going into in the midterm elections. And so they think this is absolutely crucial, similar to back in 2017, when Republicans felt it was absolutely crucial to get the tax cut done. Those same political dynamics are what pushes these things over the top. If it saves them politically, that's a different story.
Andrew, what happens to the social spending plan? It started out at being about $3.5 trillion. We know it's got to get whittled down to get both sides on board. Is there a chance that it just goes away? Because when you think about it, wouldn't that be the best outcome for the markets? Because then at least it means you're not going to raise taxes.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And there's all sorts of problems with the package because you do have to raise taxes, capital gains, upper income earners. But I just want to warn everybody, you know, if there's a compromise to get it to $2 trillion, my guess is that it's really not $2 trillion. In other words, there's social spending programs in there that are going to be very popular, family leave, child tax credit, that are never going to go away, because why would a politician vote against them once they're in place? So the cost of that package is going to be much higher, probably double whatever they have. So just to warn everybody, that's really misleading when you get them to start playing budgetary games of having it start in year two and in year five, that kind of stuff. That's nonsense. But yes, I think for the markets, that's what they're worried about right now, is the that extension of spending that the economy really just doesn't need right now to keep going. So I think that's what they're keenly worried about. And I think moderate Democrats should be very worried about the way this negotiation is going between the progressives and themselves, because the progressives are really quite zealot, like, in the way that they're going. They don't care, per se, if you get the $1.2 trillion infrastructure deal done. They're willing to kind of burn down the House to get what they want. And that's where moderates who are in Republican districts, you know, will likely lose in the 2022 midterm election. So that's something really to keep an eye on.
Alexis, Ed, I'm going to give you the last word. Biden and Dems want to be able to point to a robust economy, but they're going to have to deal with high inflation, possibly higher interest rates from the Fed. Is that a recipe for political peril for the Biden administration in 2022?
It's potentially, but I would just fundamentally disagree with some of what was just said in terms of the way in which investors have been talking to me about this. Investors really want to see some level of fiscal spending continue. And I think the greater risk to the market is not getting something done, because that fiscal cliff really does come on at the end of the year. In the tax changes that could be in here, there are changes, but they're not as severe as originally anticipated. So those are politically perilous things if you have inflation, but Democrats really do want to give voters tangible things like the child tax credit, like paid family leave, as a way of running in this midterm election. That's going to be their strategy.
All right. Ed Mills, Andy Bush, thanks, guys. We appreciate you being with us today. Want to turn now to the Fed, because policymakers at the Federal Reserve have signaled they could begin raising interest rates next year. And Fed Chair Jay Powell is under intense pressure over fears of out-of-control inflation as he seeks a second term at the top of the central bank. Joining me now with more is Bank of America Global Research Head of U.S. Economics, Michelle Meyer. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us. I want to talk to you about how much this market can stand on its own without the massive stimulus that the Fed has been throwing at it. Do you think that the economy and the market can do without the punch bowl?
Well, I don't think the punch bowl is actually going away entirely. The only thing that that's happening from the Federal Reserve is that you're starting to see movement towards gradually, very gradually and carefully starting to take back some of the accommodations. So the Fed has set the stage for tapering to begin next month. We very much believe it will be announced at the next in the meeting in November and implemented shortly after. But it's a gradual process. So the Fed will still be buying through the middle of next year. And then rate hikes, we think, are not a story until 2023. At that point, we're going to have a very hot economy. We're going to see inflationary pressures, and it's going to be highly justified for the Fed to begin hiking. But we have to remember and keep this into perspective that this is a Fed that is being intentionally late, very, very careful, very accommodative in an effort to make sure that the economy is properly supported.
So, Michelle, as an economist, you see these supply chain issues. They're persisting. Jay Powell, even last week to Congress, was talking about how they may see high inflation well into next summer. And now add to the mix oil. I mean, if it stays high, what is that going to do to the overall inflation picture? And how much is that going to trip up our economic recovery?
So I think that is the number one challenge for the economy right now is the constrained supply side. And that comes from supply chain issues that's impacting the ability to get products and goods. And we have seen that in tremendous increases in goods prices across a variety of different items. And then you also have in the labor market, a labor market that hasn't fully returned. I do see glimmers of hope for that. I think we're probably going to see greater labor force participation. But it's not the case that we're going to be able to snap our fingers and get the supply side to resolve itself. It's going to take time. And in the interim, it's facing this increase in demand, the strong consumer, all the money that's been pushed out there, and that's generating this inflation impulse. So I worry about continued pressure to inflation into the end of the year, especially when we have potentially an early and a strong holiday shopping season when we have these major constraints on the supply side. Now, the key, the critical factor in all of this is what happens to inflation expectations. Now, is it the case that the increases in inflation that we've seen, although they may end up being quote unquote transitory because they reflect this, you know, friction between demand and supply, that they actually end up getting embedded in long run inflation expectations? And then what could have been transitory ends up being more persistent because psychology changes. And that is the critical factor to watch. When you're trying to understand not only the path of monetary policy, but also the length of this cycle.
You know, all along, the Fed has said that inflation is transitory. If it becomes more persistent, will raising interest rates even incrementally at some point next week really make a difference? Will the Fed find itself behind the curve when it comes to rising inflation?
Well, look, I think that the decision to taper at the next meeting, I think, is less about, you know, where the inflation risks or, you know, trying to get ahead necessarily of this move up in expectations. I think it's about the fact that enough progress has been made in the economy, in the recovery, that you no longer need to have this extreme form of accommodation. So they're going to begin to scale back. But I think the beginning of the hiking cycle will very much be a function of when they have achieved what they think they need to in terms of price stability and this kind of inflation overshoot consistent with their new framework. So will the Fed be behind on that? I think at the moment, they're not giving any indication that they will. I mean, inflation, long-run inflation expectations are elevated, but they are not unhinged on the upside. So I do believe that they are carefully monitoring it. I think if they start to kind of get a sense or whiff of inflation expectations becoming too elevated for too long, they're going to pivot. So to me, that is a real critical factor for the Fed. And I think they'll try to move as quickly as possible. And they've been very transparent about that. If you listen to what Powell has said, what Brainard has said, the leadership of the Fed is very clear. They're not going to tolerate a troublesome inflation environment. But obviously, they have to be very careful in how they navigate this.
Michelle, I think the next most immediate hurdle for this market is going to be Friday's September jobs report on the back of a shockingly disappointing August report. This will have implications for inflation and for the Fed. What are your expectations for that jobs report?
So we're looking for 325,000 for jobs. We are a little bit below the consensus, and we think the unemployment rate will hold at 5.2%. So, you know, yes, it's not a particularly, you know, gangbusters report. It's better than the month prior. But I think for the Fed, that was perfectly acceptable because, you know, you monitor the high frequency data for late August, September, which is the period that this report covers. And it was very clear that the economy was still facing this kind of speed bump as a result of Delta and COVID on the rise. So I think as we look forward beyond this report, we are seeing some really encouraging signs of activity picking up in the leisure side of the economy, people going back out and trying to book air travel and going back out to restaurants and to entertainment. And all of that should lend itself to stronger job creation down the line. So I think that in a sense, this report is a little bit backward looking. And I think for the Fed, they're really pretty committed at the moment, I think, to begin tapering in November, realizing that it's going to be a process. They're not going to complete tapering until the middle of next year. So they have some wiggle room in terms of how they're communicating their stance of policy, given what they see in the upcoming data.
Yeah, and you can bet they're going to be looking at wage pressures as well. Michelle Meyer, absolutely. Thanks so much. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, we're going to have more on the market's outlook with D.R. Barton of Wichita Financial Group. We're live at the NASDAQ. Back after this. Welcome back, everybody, to Market Movers live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. Ugly start to the week on Wall Street. All three major indexes sharply lower as that rotation out of tech continues. You see there the NASDAQ now down more than 2%. Bond yields, by the way, continuing to rise and spook investors. Joining me now is D.R. Barton, principal at Wichita Financial Group. D.R., great to have you with us. You know, earlier I had a market strategist on talking about how this may be more than that 10% correction. Could we possibly be heading to bear territory here in Q4?
Well, a bear pullback of 20%, I think, is much bigger than anything on my radar screen, Alexis. Could we get some more downside here? Yes. You know, we got the tech selling off really hard today on essentially the Facebook news and the potential for regulatory headwinds for the rest of the big five. I don't see this as the big pullback where we're going to go down 20% and get into bearish territory. And there's a bunch of reasons why, but the big ones are we're still awash in so much money that overcomes so much other bad news that I think that's the one umbrella that's still going to keep this market propped up for a while.
Does it help us overcome rising inflation, persistent supply chain issues, and also what's going to be coming out of Washington, D.C.? But we still don't have a deal yet on the debt ceiling, DR.
Yeah, you know, all of those things. I did not mention the debt ceiling in my notes, but I've been looking at the same things you're looking at, Alexis. And I believe the big one is inflation. But because of the Fed's stance and because they've been calling it transitory and because they keep saying moderated and other things, I think dealing with that and the impact on the markets is going to be pushed down the road a bit. The debt ceiling is kind of a wild card, especially as we get toward the end of the year. Could we get toward another fiscal cliff? I know one of your earlier guests mentioned that. I think that's a possibility. All of those overhangs are there, but the thing that I've seen over and over again, Alexis, is every time we see that, every time we get one of these pullbacks, the market participants go, yeah, but I don't want to miss out if we get another big leg up. And I think that's what we're going to see coming into the end of the year. One more big leg up before we have any sort of reckoning.
All right, let me ask, Art, do you see us having one more big leg up, even if bond yields continue to rise? When we saw that sharp rise in yields after the Fed's last meeting, I mean, true, the yield on the 10-year is still only at about 1.5%, but it seemed to be enough to spook investors. Do you see rising yields as a trend through Q4, and is it going to continue to bother equity investors?
I will give you a yes and a no. I see those yields continuing to trend up, and then a no that it's going to continue to spook investors, unless we get a big hop like we did on the day you mentioned, where the markets dropped 2% across the board, across all major indexes or more. That day certainly was a bond yield-centric day. Without another big hop like that, if we just keep trending up, we got to remember one of the things that tells us if those bond yields are trending up is the expectation for an expanding economy. And that is not a negative for the market. So gradual good, big discrete moves, not so good as far as the equity market's concerned.
What are your thoughts on oil right now? I'm taking a look at crude closing in on $80 a barrel after that news coming out of OPEC, that they're not going to change what they're pumping out on a daily basis. Do you feel like energy is a good place to park some money right now? And how do you see it playing into the overall economic recovery?
Yeah, I think we're going to continue to see elevated crude rates and natural gas, as we know, has exploded and pulled back and exploded again. So we're going to see energy doing those sorts, staying high again, because we're seeing the expanding of the economy still. We can't ship stuff fast enough. All of the things that we're seeing in the background and the supply chain upsets will eventually moderate a bit. I think that's still going to be a bouncy picture when we're oversupplied, undersupplied, oversupplied for a few more quarters or more. But all of that says, yes, we need more energy products. That's a good thing for oil prices. And yeah, I could see putting some money to work in that sector in particular.
Before we let you go, in the 30 seconds I have left, are you a buyer on a day like today? And if so, what are you looking at?
Yeah, I love these pullbacks right now. And until the markets tell me something drastically different on the technicals, Alexis, I'm going to continue to be. Anytime you get the big techs pulling back like this, I like to take a swing at those, a nibble at those as they pull back. But some of the other places I think that are looking continually good heading into hopefully some sort of infrastructure bill, every time we get a pullback in the industrials and the materials, I think that's a good place to be going into the new year.
All right, Dr. Barton, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it. Straight ahead, how investors are dealing with ongoing regulatory issues across China. MacroLens chief strategist Brian McCarthy is going to join us right after the break. China's regulatory crackdown has sent overseas stocks spiraling downward. Joining me now is MacroLens chief strategist and managing principal, Brian McCarthy. Brian, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. Lots of news coming out of China today, so glad you're with us. And I want to start with Evergrande, the real estate developer in a lot of trouble there in China. I know that shares were halted earlier in Hong Kong pending some news. There was talk that there might be a takeover bid for the company. What are you hearing?
Sure. So it looks like the news overnight was related to a bid for 51% stake in Evergrande's property management business. So taking care of the buildings they've built, which obviously somebody is going to need to handle in an ongoing manner after Evergrande is effectively dissolved, which is what we're seeing take place. About $5 billion, to put that in perspective, their total debt is around $300 billion. But there was other news over the weekend, which is interesting as well. A bond popped up from an entity called Jumbo Fortune, which had engaged in a joint venture with Evergrande and claims that Evergrande has guaranteed this bond that missed a coupon payment today, it sounds like. This bond was not on Evergrande's balance sheet. And there was another medium-sized developer called Fantasia that had a similar experience today, was also suspended in Hong Kong, where a bond that they had guaranteed is going to default, and this guarantee is nowhere to be found on their financials, apparently. So, you know, the Evergrande problem is big. It's only going to get bigger as it evolves, because we're just going to find that the accounting is not robust in China, as we all know. So, again, $5 billion probably coming in terms of an asset sale. It is their most liquid saleable asset, so that's great, but this is a drop in the bucket.
Wow. All right. So then talk to me about the tentacles this thing has. Is this the beginning of the end of the real estate development boom in China? And do we have to worry about the effects of that here on our shores in the U.S.?
Yes, I believe it is the end of the real estate boom in China. I'd say investor sentiment over the last month or so has morphed from expecting some kind of bailout to now the sort of the optimistic spin is that they're going to ring fence the situation. If by that we mean they're not going to allow banks to withdraw credit from the system willy-nilly and cause a Lehman-like collapse in credit, then yes, they'll ring fence it to that extent. But you have maybe as many as 1,100 developments, it now appears, in China in various state of disarray. Evergrande's business has come to a halt. Suppliers want money. Buyers want the apartments that they've paid for. I don't think this is ring-fenceable in terms of its effect on the Chinese real estate market. So this is the bell ringing to speculators in China, telling them, okay, it's over. Xi Jinping means it when he says houses are for living in, not speculation. And I think the sentiment Humpty Dumpty is going to break, that's going to be in a way that's very difficult to put together, I think. In terms of ramifications for the U.S., I've been listening here. Great segment regarding the supply chain issues in the U.S., the Fed maybe tweaking in a more hawkish direction. And I think it's important to note that this situation in China is related in a reflexive way. So Chinese monetary policy there's a restrictor plate on Chinese monetary policy, which is the managed RMB exchange rate. So when the dollar's really easy and global liquidity is really easy, China has plenty of flexibility to try to deal with something like a real estate bust. So when they made this decision to prick the bubble finally, they did it under the assumption that global liquidity conditions were going to be really easy, the dollar was going to be weak, and they had room to deal with it. If we get a Fed that is forced into tightening more quickly than they had wanted to because of transitory inflation that's proving not to be transitory because of these supply issues, and you see the dollar continue to strengthen as it has started to do in recent weeks, then we need to assess China's ability to deal with its real estate fallout in that framework, which is going to be much more difficult. So these situations of these supply chain, in supply-driven inflation in the U.S., its effect on Fed policy, and how China can and will try to deal with the fallout in its real estate market are related in a way that's self-reinforcing. And I think this is the negative undertone to these markets we're seeing recently.
Brian, today we saw the Biden administration unveil his policy with China, or at least his trade policy with China. It looks a lot like the Trump policy. They're going to keep those tariffs on a number of different Chinese imports as they try to have China make good on those phase one promises. How should investors think about positioning their portfolios with so much uncertainty still now in a new administration swirling around trade and China?
Right. Well, the speech was billed as revealing the Biden administration's trade strategy. I didn't really see one. there was a declaration that China is not meeting its commitments with regard to the phase one deal, which everybody is aware of. There was a threat of frank discussions in response, but we didn't really get anything more than that. What we did get from USTRTI and from quotes from unnamed officials in the press this morning was an acknowledgement, again, that of something everybody knows, which is China is not changing. So we're not going to change their behavior. China's message is very clear. We're going to do what we do. If you want to decouple, try it and see how you like that. So they're taking a very tough line. This is a very difficult situation for the Biden administration to try to deal with, particularly when we already have widespread supply chain problems globally. So the global economy and the Fed, they need a decoupling threat to global supply chains. We need this like we need a hole in the head right now. So the U.S. doesn't really have a lot of leverage to respond, and it's really unclear that they have any plan for what to do next. So I think this is something that by necessity markets will be okay with, because I just don't really see the Biden administration having enunciated any clear next steps. And I think there's just going to be a lot of talk and a lot of punting on this issue.
All right. Decoupling may just be our next big buzzword. Brian McCarthy of Macro Lens, thanks so much for being with us. And that's going to wrap up this special edition of Market Movers live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Alexis Christopher. Stay tuned. More Yahoo Finance live and the sell-off right after this.
President Trump speaking to Yahoo Finance in an exclusive interview. We will get his take on the economic recovery and what he's calling scary inflation, the ongoing debate over the debt limit, his plans for 2024, and much, much more. We will have Adam's interview with President Trump for you in just a bit. As the U.S. crosses another grim milestone, recording more than 700,000 COVID deaths, Dr. Fauci is warning that it's still too soon to tell whether or not it will be safe to gather for the holidays. Dr. Tyson Bell of the University of Virginia, he will join us to explain. And the biggest showdown the NFL has seen in quite some time, Tom Brady returning to Gillette Stadium last night. It was the most watched Sunday night football game by far this season, breaking in more than 22 million viewers. We are going to break down the Tom Brady effect